the pulse in her wrists. A physician had to keep some distance, but once in a while a simple story would catch her unawares, sliding like a needle through a crack in a thimble to embed itself deeply, without warning, in tender flesh. Miss Branson was looking at Anna with an expression that couldn't be identified. Not pain or sorrow or regret, and nothing of anger. Anna could not rail against an insensitive and cruel employer in the face of such placid acceptance. She certainly could not disturb the woman's peaceful state of mind, not now or ever.
"Things never quite turn out the way you imagined, do they?" Miss Branson said, her voice low and almost amused in tone. "You have to pay attention to the moment in your hands before it's gone. Now, would you have any use for my hats? I don't like to leave my bills unpaid, and you have looked after me very well."
Anna changed into the summer weight frock she had brought with her, brushed out her hair and put it up again in a loose chignon on the back of her head, changed her shoes, and picked up the straw boater that would protect her from the sun on the river. She regarded herself in the mirror. Margaret was fond of pointing out that Jack had done wonders for Anna's complexion, making it more of a subtle accusation than a compliment. Anna saw that it was true. Her color was high and her skin clear. She wondered if sexual frustration could be as invigorating as sex itself. Wondered what Margaret would say to this question. The idea put a smile on her face. She hadn't been alone with Jack for a very long time, but that would change soon. It was just after one and he would be waiting downstairs. She was suddenly very impatient to see him, and had to remind herself that it would not fill patients or staff with confidence to see a doctor skipping down the hall. She thought in passing of Maura Kingsolver, the surgeon coming on shift. Fortunately, there were no pending surgeries that she had to be informed about. It seemed as if Anna might really get out of the hospital on time. Jack was talking to Mr. Abernathy in the lobby. He stood with his hands in his pockets, rocking back on his heels, his chin lowered to his chest. A powerfully built man at ease in his own skin, listening closely to an old man's story. He had been raised in a household that valued stories and the people who told them. It was one part of what made him good at his work. He was wearing a beautifully cut suit that fit him perfectly. A summer weight wool of a deep buff color. His jacket was open to reveal a checked vest buttoned over a soft white shirt, and a copper-colored silk tie in a loose bow around a standing collar. His sister's influence, and one way in which Anna could never compete. She paid little attention to fashion, and was satisfied to let her aunt and cousin choose for her, as they had today, because it wouldn't have occurred to her that the clothes she wore at the hospital were not right for an afternoon on the river, or not until it was too late to go home and change. Jack looked up and caught her eye. His whole face came alive as he broke into a smile. He was here for her. That odd and wondrous thought was in her mind still when the wide front doors flew open with a tremendous crash that made Anna jump in place. An ambulance driver appeared, holding up one end of a stretcher, backing through the door carefully. Jack and Mr. Abernathy were there before Anna even realized they were moving, blocking her view while they helped maneuver the stretcher all the way in and then carrying it through to the examination room. A young woman wrapped in bloody sheets was struggling and writhing to free herself when the ambulance doctor tried to put three fingers to her throat to time her pulse. The driver stood back, arms crossed over his chest, looking studiously bored. To Anna, he said, "This one's asking for a Dr. Savard." Ambulance drivers were notoriously hard to shock and often simply rude, but Anna had no time to teach him manners. "You're in the way," Anna said. "Step outside." Ambulance doctors were employees of the police department.
Generally, men newly out of medical college and in need of practical experience. Jack knew most of them, at least by sight. But this one he had never met before.
I'm an intern at Bellevue. Neil Graham. You're Dr. Savard?
I'm one of two Dr. Savards at this hospital. This lady is a stranger to me. She must be my cousin's patient.
You'll have to do, said Graham. She can't wait.
Anna's expression cleared, all her questions and confusion leaving her face to be replaced by a focused calm. She looked over her shoulder at Mr. Abernathy. Is Dr. Kingsolver available?
Already in surgery, he said. Room 2 is free.
Orderlies appeared out of a side door to scoop up the stretcher. To Neil Graham, Anna said, It is the first operating room on the right. Please stay with her until I get there. I'll just be a moment. Then she turned to Jack. I'm sorry. He nodded, adding a half shrug. He understood very well the regret, and knew, too, that it would last only until she stood in front of her patient. The woman's condition would drive all other thoughts out of her mind. He said,
I'll go to the ferry dock to explain.
I'm sorry about your day, too. She was already moving away, but she changed direction and dashed toward him, stopping short to go up on tiptoe and press a kiss to his mouth. A fleeting touch he might have imagined if not for the scent of her skin. Then she was gone, flying down the hall to the operating rooms. Jack had almost reached the cab waiting for him when another pulled up, and a man leapt down before the horses came to a halt. He wore a black wool suit despite the warm weather, and a matching bowler pulled down over frizzled red hair.
Hold on, the cabbie bellowed. Hold on there. What about my fare?
The man yelled over his shoulder,
Archer Campbell, postal inspector. You'll get your fare.
I'll get double my fare if you make me chase you down for it,
the cabbie shouted, even as the man disappeared into the hospital.
Or I'll get the police after you, postal inspector or not.
When Anna came in, three nurses were already going about the business of preparing the operating room and the patient, who was still struggling despite firm hands and calm words. The nurses talked to her in a studiously attentive but calm tone, as they had been taught to do. As Anna herself had once learned when she was a medical student and new to this world that was now her own. They provided Anna with information without prompting. Pulse, 150 and thready. Temperature, 104. Anna was still trying to attach the name Mrs. Campbell to a memory. A patient of Sophie's she had been worried about, when the woman shouted,
Dr. Savard!
And again,
Please, Dr. Savard!
Time was of the essence, but a terrified patient could not be ignored. She went to stand beside the operating table. I'm Dr. Anna Savard. I think you must be a patient of my cousin Sophie's. I will do my best for you, Mrs. Campbell. Can you tell me about your condition? What exactly was done? She put a hand on the woman's abdomen and flinched as she shrieked in pain, curling away from Anna's touch. In a whisper, she said,
Where is Dr. Savard?
She has left the hospital staff and is moving to Europe. Can you tell me what you've done? The woman shook her head fiercely and turned her face away. Mrs. Campbell, Anna said, Your situation is dire. You must realize that. I will do everything in my power to help you, but you must prepare yourself. Do you have a message for me to pass on? Again, the violent shake of the head. Her voice was broken and hoarse, but Anna heard her clearly.
I want nothing now but an end to it all.
Anna said, Nurse Mitchard, please put the patient under as quickly as possible. There is not one second to waste. No time to waste, and still, hygiene could not be forgotten. Anna stood at the sink, scrubbing her hands and lower arms furiously, counting out the seconds to herself. Beside her, the ambulance doctor held his hands and shirt sleeves both under running water and was watching the blood wash away.
He introduced himself as Neil Graham, an intern from Bellevue.
"What can you tell me?" she asked him.
She admitted nothing. Profuse hemorrhaging, guarding, pain on rebound, in and out of delirium. I couldn't examine her properly in the ambulance, but by the smell, she's septic.
The husband?
Neighbor sent word. I'm guessing he's on his way.
Dr. Savard, one of the nurses called, a note of panic in her voice. We've got a prolapsed umbilical cord already presenting.
To Neil Graham, Anna said. Anything else?
Just that she wanted to see Dr. Savard.
Thank you, Anna said. I'll take it from here.
Could I observe?
Anna paused. He was young, but his demeanor was professional and his interest seemed sincere.
I may need another pair of hands, she said, but you'll have to get rid of that shirt and scrub in properly, nails especially. Don't spare on the carbolic. Nurse Walker is circulating. She'll find you a tunic.
When Anna came to the operating table, her hands still damp and stinging from the carbolic acid, Mrs. Campbell had already been calmed by the ether. She was strapped to the extended stirrups in the lithotomy position, her knees flexed and canted outward, her legs and torso draped. Instruments newly out of the autoclave were arranged neatly on sterile trays. The nursing staff stood waiting for Anna to begin. Helen Mitchard sat at Mrs. Campbell's head, monitoring anesthesia. She had already started to give the patient saline injections by means of a cannula, which might make some small difference.
Status?
She gave a sharp shake of her head, reaffirming what Anna already knew. It would take a miracle to turn this around. Anna folded back the draping to reveal fresh dressings that were already soaked with blood and discharge. The effluvia was enough to make her head snap back. Septicemia had an unmistakable smell, but there was also a strong odor of feces. Whoever had operated on this woman had perforated her bowel. Anna glanced at the nurse beside her.
Nurse Hawkins,
the young woman supplied. I'm going to need a good 3 gallons of saline to irrigate. And when we're done here today, I want to talk to you about your grasp of human anatomy. She picked up a uterine sound that would give her an idea of the extent of the damage.
This is not an umbilical cord, Nurse Hawkins. It's a loop of lower intestine.
Jack stopped by Verhoeven's house to tell Sophie and Cap that the family party had boarded the ferry and departed as scheduled to cruise the East River, without Anna.
Or you, said Sophie. There will be some very disappointed cousins.
They sat down to eat lunch and talk through the changes to the day's plans. Cap said, Bring her back here when she's free. We're planning on eating on the terrace in the evening. We have a good view of the new bridge from there. Sophie walked Jack to the door. She put her hand on his lower arm, lowering her voice.
Cap's been pushing himself far too hard, Sophie said. But I really would like you to bring Anna and we'll eat together. Cap and I will both retire quite early, given...
Tomorrow.
She nodded, a little flustered.
So you two will have the terrace to yourselves.
Her expression was completely innocent, but Jack had begun to figure Sophie out, and he saw something like quiet amusement in her eyes. He leaned over and kissed her cheek, felt her start, and then relax.
It's good that you and Anna found each other, she said. I would worry about her while I'm gone, if she didn't have you.
It was past 3 by the time Jack got back to the New Amsterdam, where he found Anna waiting for him in her office. To his gently raised brow, she said,
Her blood loss was too severe and the infection too far advanced. She began to convulse and I lost her. Someday, when blood transfusions are safe, cases like this one will take a better end.
Jack sat down across from her, rested his elbow on the arm of the chair and his chin on his palm, and regarded Anna. Her demeanor was resigned,
as it must be, he understood, for anyone who practiced medicine. He said,
"Her husband passed me on my way out earlier."
Anna closed her eyes. "Yes, I know."
"Very distraught."
"Angry, I would say. Confrontational." When I told him she had asked for Dr. Savard by name, he looked at me as if I had been caught in a lie. He said, "She has a proper doctor at Women's Hospital. She has no business in a place like this." As if the New Amsterdam were a brothel. I was glad he didn't ask me about a cause of death. I don't think he would have liked hearing about an abortion.
"Has the coroner been notified?"
She stood and stretched. "Yes, Mr. Abernathy took care of it. There will be an autopsy and an inquest, and I'll have to testify. But not until Monday. Shall we go?" In the end, Anna was glad to have missed the family party on the river. Once Cap and Sophie had sailed, they would spend the afternoon together in the garden with the visitors. For now, it suited her to sit on Cap's terrace in the late afternoon sun with the people she loved best in the world. Then Sophie surprised her. As soon as Anna started to describe the emergency surgery that had caused the change in plans, her cousin went very still.
"Don't you remember, Anna? I told you about Mrs. Campbell. You must remember. It was the day you went to Hoboken in my place."
Jack sat forward, his attention suddenly focused. Sophie was saying, "Her fourth boy, the oldest barely five, and she was terribly afraid of another pregnancy." Anna did recall. "The woman married to the postal inspector."
"Ah," Jack said. "I crossed paths with the man when he got to the New Amsterdam."
There was a small, fraught silence in which Anna knew she and Sophie were thinking the same thing. Mrs. Campbell had asked about contraceptives, and Sophie had sent her a pamphlet, anonymously. Sophie asked,
"How was he with you?"
Anna would have liked to forget Archer Campbell, who had raged at her like a man dressing down a groom responsible for the loss of a valuable mare. She had held on to her temper and swallowed her irritation, and most of all, she had subdued her own feelings about losing a patient. Campbell was condescending and insulting, but he was also newly bereaved and must be shown both patience and compassion. Nothing she said had satisfied him, and in the end, he went off to see what was keeping the coroner.
"He didn't know she was pregnant,"
Anna said to Sophie. Sophie inclined her head to one side, as if she had something to say, but then thought better of it. Instead, she hummed, a low, rough sound.
"He'll never accept that she had an abortion.
I can only imagine what he's telling the coroner." Jack rubbed her shoulder.
"They'll do an autopsy, won't they?"
Anna made that same soft sound, neither yes or no.
"Get used to that sound," Cap told Jack.
He sat a little apart from them, wrapped in blankets even in the warmth of the sun. To Anna, he seemed content and agitated all at once, as though he had just come back from a long and strenuous hike and was determined to leave on another in short order.
"Used to what sound?" Jack asked.
"That rough humming in the back of the throat. They both do it. Ask any medical question that has to do with an actual human being, and their voices drop a register, and all you get is that noncommittal throat clearing. I think they're taught how to do it in medical school, like a secret handshake."
Sophie gave him a half smile.
"Oh, dear, who told you about the secret handshake?"
Cap turned to Anna.
"How many vertebrae in the human spine?"
She considered not answering, and then gave in.
5 fused together that make up the sacrum, the 4 coccygeal bones that form the tailbone, then 7 cervical, 12 thoracic, and 5 lumbar vertebrae.
"Thank you," Cap said. "I'll get out my abacus to add that all together later. Now I've been meaning to say that I've had a stitch in my side all day.
Does that mean something?
Anna and Sophie turned toward him, heads canted at the same angle, and hummed in exactly the same key. Then they exchanged a glance and laughed.
You've figured us out, Sophie said to Cap. Now I will have to show you the secret handshake.
So he's right, Jack said. You do hum when you're asked a medical question.
I suppose so.
Anna rubbed a knuckle between her brows.
It's a way to encourage the patient to talk without interrupting or giving away findings.
The patient doesn't want to know what you're thinking?
Anna said.
Certainly. But it's a truism that patients lie without reservation, and anything I say will only add to the confusion.
Patients often lie for no obvious reason, Sophie added. Most don't even realize that they are lying.
There's a trick to it. They tell you what's wrong, Anna went on, and you have to try to sort out what's true, what's supposition, imagination, wishful thinking, and unadulterated prevarication. So, you see, you can't give your thoughts away.
I would guess it's a lot like police work, Cap said.
Sophie looked surprised.
In a way, people who are sick often feel guilty about work left undone, or the people who need them. It's one of the things that get in the way of figuring out what's wrong.
There is some similarity, Jack said. There are people who will confess to any crime out of fear of the police.
Anna thought again of her patient's husband. If Archer Campbell had been able to read my mind, he might well have shot me on the spot.
Jack frowned. What were you accusing him of in your mind?
With some vehemence, Sophie said, a man has to be both blind and heartless not to see that the person he sleeps beside every night lives in terror.
That's a strong word, Cap said.
Hardly strong enough. Look at what her desperation drove her to.
Anna clapped her hands suddenly.
Too dark a subject for a beautiful summer afternoon. I came hoping for Mrs. Harrison's wafer cake and coffee.
Sophie got up.
I'll tell her we're ready.
Halfway to the French doors that opened into the house proper, she turned back.
Cap, you'd tell me if you did have a stitch in your side, wouldn't you?
And smiled, embarrassed, when they all laughed. They played cards and talked about the Greber house and Aunt Quinlan's delight at the turn of events that would install Anna and Jack, if not in the same house, close enough to see every day.
It needs a lot of work, Jack said. The plumbing and gas lines and wall sconces have to be replaced, and none of the fittings in the bedrooms are sound. I wonder that the place didn't burn down long ago.
It's a big house, Sophie said, the corner of her mouth curling upward. It will take you some time to fill it up.
Anna wrinkled her nose at her cousin. Don't start.
I've been wondering if you might like to put in a suite of rooms for a private practice, Jack said to Anna.
Anna felt her mouth fall open before she could catch herself. She closed it on a click, trying to find something sensible to say in the flurry of thoughts that were racing by.
Jack raised a brow. Not a good idea.
I don't know, Anna said. I'll have to think about it.
You are grimacing, Cap said.
Am I?
Anna shook her head to clear her thoughts. I suppose I am. It's just that there are so many decisions to make. Jack's sisters have been bombarding me already about drapery fabrics and table linen and bedding.
Poor Anna, Cap said, forced to choose between periwinkle and primrose, silk and brocade and linen.
It's worse than that, Anna said. I have to talk about prices.
There you have it, Cap said to Jack, our Anna's biggest secret. Any merchant can overcharge her without fear of accusation. I think she'd break out in a rash before she challenged a price.
I'll have to pay attention now, Anna said.
or I'll bankrupt us before we get started and send Jack's sisters to the poorhouse while I'm at it. He says I can't pay them or even reimburse them for materials.
They would be insulted, Jack agreed. And you won't put them in the poorhouse. My mother has everything well in hand.
You see, Anna said, I'm doomed. But you like the house, Sophie prompted. Oh, I love the house, and I especially love the garden, weeds and all. Then everything will work out in the end.
Sophie leaned over and kissed Anna's cheek. You must tell yourself that every morning and every evening, and Jack must remind you when you forget.
They told stories, Jack about his family and his time studying in Italy, Cap and Sophie and Anna about their childhood misadventures, most of which put Anna in a central and less than angelic spotlight. As the sun was setting, they ate a light supper of lamb, new potatoes, and peas braised in cream and dressed with mint. All Cap's favorites. Which reminded Anna that it was also the last time he would sit down to Mrs. Harrison's cooking. Her appetite left her just that suddenly, and it was hard work to get down even half of what she had been served. When Jack went to sit closer to Cap to talk about the journey, Sophie's mind turned back to Janine Campbell.
She came to see me weeks ago, asking questions I couldn't answer for fear that Comstock was behind it. She was distraught, but I didn't think she was in such despair that she would risk what she risked. You think she aborted herself?
Anna said. From the angle of the puncture wounds, yes. But in the end, I don't think it's possible to know unless whoever did it comes forward to confess, and you know that won't happen. The coroner will have an opinion. Anna took her cousin's hand.
It's a terrible thing, Sophie, but you have to put it out of your mind now. You have nothing to feel guilty about.
I don't feel guilty, Sophie said quietly. I am just terribly sorry and sad. For her and for those little boys. And I'm frustrated, that I have to admit. I may as well have been bound and gagged when she came to see me, for all the good I did her.
It was hardly 7 when Cap excused himself to retire for the night. The fireworks were still an hour off, but he was wan, his hair and face damp with perspiration. They all knew what these things meant, and it would do no good to point out the obvious. And still, Anna found it difficult to stand back when he was so clearly in distress. If by some miracle he lived another 30 years with tuberculosis, she knew she would never be able to accept the necessity of distance between them. She heard herself say, "Do you remember when we were little? How we napped together in Uncle Quinlan's hammock between the apricot trees.
I remember you turning over so suddenly that I ended up on the ground."
Cap's smile was far away and sad. And still, Anna was glad to have raised this image, this picture of themselves as children with no worries on a summer afternoon, able to sleep in the shade of trees heavy with fruit, simply because it pleased them.
To Jack, Cap said. "You'll have to watch out for her. She's a turbulent sleeper."
"It will be my privilege to watch out for her," Jack said. "Always."
When they were alone, they sat in companionable silence for a good while. "Sophie has always been the soul of calm in any storm," Anna said. "She is fearless when it comes to her patients. She'll confront anyone, even against her own best interests. But after tomorrow, her natural inclination to protect Cap will be underwritten by law. And I'm glad of it, for both of them."
"You find it hard to let him go," Jack said, "to say goodbye."
She nodded, not trusting her voice. When she had control of it again, she said, I've always wondered if what Sophie experienced in New Orleans during the war took the ability to be frightened from her.
She had a difficult time of it, I take it.
Anna gave him a grim smile. I don't know exactly. She has never spoken of it to any of us. I'm sure Cap knows, but I have never pressed her for the details. Someday, maybe she will talk to me about it. I've been short with everyone this last week, but I'm especially sorry to have been short with her.
Jack leaned forward, took her by the wrist, and pulled her out of her chair and onto his lap.
They'll be gone at this time tomorrow, Anna said, pressing her cheek to his shoulder. I know that, but it still doesn't feel real.
The urge to tease her was more than he could withstand. Just now, you feel pretty real to me. He slid his hand from her waist down over her hip, and she shivered and turned her face to hide her smile.
You make me blush like a little girl.
You are anything but a little girl to me, Savard.
Anna began to yawn and then caught herself.
You have a busy day tomorrow, too, Jack said. Do you want to skip the fireworks for a good night's sleep?
After a very long pause, she said, It will be hours before anyone comes home.
Her voice had gone low and a little rough.
I can't remember the last time I was in the house by myself.
The sound of band music came to them on the breeze, drums and trumpets and horns too faint to make out a melody. Such a fine summer evening, Jack said against her hair. It would be a shame to spend it alone.
They walked to Waverly Place at a comfortable pace, holding hands and talking very little. The city streets were far emptier than usual, but as it turned out, the citizens of Manhattan had only migrated upward onto roofs. It seemed that everyone who had not gone to the new bridge had found a high place to perch, and voices drifted down to them now and then, fretting children, young people excited by the novelty and the day's festivities. There were rooster calls back and forth, followed by laughter.
What is that about? Anna wondered.
Mrs. Roebling had the honor of crossing the bridge first, since she did all the work after her husband was injured, Jack told her. Apparently, with a rooster in her lap for good luck.
Good luck.
Anna had never taken comfort in such ideas, but she wished just now that she could. If there was any good luck to be had in the world, Sophie and Cap should have it all. Where has your mind gone? Jack's voice, low and a little gruff, set something off in her, a prickling that raced down her back to spread out and out. She pressed his hand and leaned against his arm, as if she meant to push him off the sidewalk. Jack Mezzanotte, as solid as a wall.
I'm just where I want to be, Anna said. Except for one odd thing. I've walked this way home too many times to count. But tonight, it seems to have stretched to double the normal distance.
You're impatient, he pulled her closer. And that puts me in a good mood.
He kissed her, full-mouthed, intent, his hands framing her face. When he lifted his head, he said,
You make the most intriguing sounds, little squeaks and a soft clicking at the back of your throat, as if you were drinking me in.
That's a backhanded compliment, Anna said, laughing, if it's a compliment at all.
She tried to pull away, but he wouldn't let her. He spread his hands to span the full width of her back.
Take me to your bed, Savard, and I'll come up with compliments to make you blush for days.
They ran the rest of the way, breathless, laughing.
Instead of using the front door, they circled around to the passageway that led to the carriage house, passing the small stable and the garden sheds, The chicken coop closed up tight, an ice house. The air smelled of newly cut grass and hay, ripening compost and flowering lilac bushes, taller even than Jack, that divided the working parts of the garden from the rest. Anna went ahead, gesturing for him to wait where he was. He wandered through the garden, lit by the moon and the reflected glow of the street lamps. It surprised him still, this quiet island behind brick walls. There were fruit and specimen trees and flower beds that even his father could not have found fault with. A rose arbor overhung with vines weighed down with buds, the neat rows where vegetables had been planted. The pergola reminded him of home, where the family ate out of doors in the warm months at a long table under a grape arbor. Someone familiar with the way things done in Italy and southern France had designed this place, for privacy and comfort. Jack sat down on a wide chaise longue upholstered in dark velvet and piled with cushions. Shadows moved with the breeze, every leaf and shoot, blossom and vine dancing. Jack thought, it seems I am turning into a poet. Now he realized that Anna wasn't going to take him to her bed after all, but she would come to him here. They would lie down together in a bower of blossoming lilac and wait for the fireworks to arch across the sky. And he would have her here. It had been too long, and he wasn't willing to wait even one more hour. Things hadn't gone as planned today, but it occurred to him that a doctor was the right wife for him. She really would understand when work kept him out late or took him away unexpectedly. He knew more than a few detectives with unhappy wives and sour views on marriage, something that had kept him from thinking too much about the institution for himself. Until Anna. And now she came around the corner carrying an old-fashioned hurricane lamp, as round and bright as a sun in the new dark. It covered her in light and lifted her face out of the night, and Jack heard himself catch his breath. She had changed into a loose white gown of some fine fabric and let her hair out of its pleats and tucks so that the breeze sent it twisting and twirling around her like a dark lacy shawl. The words that came to mind were ones he could not say. To tell Anna Savard that she looked like an angel would embarrass them both with such triteness. To say she was the most beautiful thing he had ever seen in his life would diminish the truth of it. And so, he got up and went to her. He took the lamp from her and put it on the table. The pergola came to life. The crockery vase filled with white lilac and deep red rose de rest he had sent from the greenhouse. The blue leather binding of a book that had been left out. The jumble of cushions, yellows and greens and pinks, that lined the chaise longue with its velvet upholstery worn thin and silky as a woman's skin. She was looking over her shoulder into the dark garden, as if she did not trust herself to look at him. He caught her wrist, threaded his fingers through hers, long and strong and tough with constant scrubbing, and still gentle enough to remind him that she was female, and fragile in ways she would never admit to him or herself. Look, she said, her voice hoarse as he drew her into his arms. Look, Jack, the first fireflies. He took his time with her, exploring skin that never saw the light of day, the backs of her knees, the soft crease between thigh and buttock, the small of her back. He pressed his face to her belly and slid up to nuzzle her breasts, suckling with a wet and greedy mouth until she gasped and tried to twist away. He would have none of it. He held her down to take what she wanted to give him. And here was another shock. She liked being at his mercy. With some small part of her mind, she realized that the fireworks had begun. Colors fell like rain in the whispering dark. Chapter 22.
New York Sun. Friday, May 25th, 1883. Belmont heir to Mary Creole. There is great agitation among the upper classes of this city about a wedding to take place this morning at Trinity Chapel. The groom is Peter Verhoeven, Esquire, son of Anton Verhoeven, a prominent Belgian architect, deceased, and Clorinda Belmont of this city, also deceased. Through his mother, Mr. Verhoeven, an attorney, inherited a large portion of the Belmont fortune, as well as a fine home on Park Place. The bride is Sophie Adélie Savard, a beautiful mulatto lady, highly educated and refined in person and habit. The couple have known each other from childhood. According to the city clerk, a marriage license has been issued. In light of this fact, members of the Belmont and related families declared the intention to disown Mr. Verhoeven should this scandalous and unnatural union go forward. Both bride and groom have declined to be interviewed, but the son has learned that they plan to leave for Europe after the wedding ceremony and luncheon. They will travel to Switzerland, where Mr. Verhoeven will be admitted to a private sanatorium for treatment of advanced consumption. His new wife, who is also a qualified physician, will attend him there. New York Sun, Friday, May 25th, 1883. Mother's tragic death. Four little boys left behind. Malpractice suspected. Mrs. Janine Lavoie Campbell, aged 26 years, of 19 Charles Street, died yesterday afternoon at the New Amsterdam Charity Hospital as a result of possible medical malpractice. Originally from Maine, Mrs. Campbell was employed by the Bangor Post Office until her marriage to Mr. Archer Campbell of this city. The marriage was a fruitful one, producing four boys in 5 years. Yesterday morning, a neighbor called on Mrs. Campbell and found her to be very unwell. A police ambulance was summoned, and Dr. Neil Graham of that service examined Mrs. Campbell and declared her to be in danger of her life. In accordance with her wishes, Mrs. Campbell was transported to the New Amsterdam Charity Hospital, to be delivered into the care of Dr. Sophie Savard, who was not present. Instead, Mrs. Campbell was seen and operated by Dr. Anna Savard. She did not survive the surgery. The coroner was notified by the hospital, and an autopsy was arranged with all speed. The report of the post-mortem examination carried out yesterday evening has not yet been made public. Confusion in this case stems from the fact that two female physicians with the surname Savard were involved in treating Mrs. Campbell. Dr. Anna Savard and Dr. Sophie Savard are reportedly distant cousins who studied together at Women's Medical School. Dr. Sophie Savard is a mulatto. How she came to have a white lady of good family as a patient is a matter still under investigation. Mr. Archer Campbell, a senior postal inspector and husband of the deceased, directed that his wife's body be taken to his home. This young mother of four was, by all accounts, a virtuous woman beyond reproach. Jack stood outside Trinity Chapel watching a couple dozen people, Bonners and Ballantines, Scotts and Quinlans and Savards, greeting each other. Small groups would drift together and then apart, but nobody ever strayed very far from Anna's Aunt Quinlan. The old lady stood holding the Russo girls by the hand, both of them too excited to do anything but bounce in place, while she talked to daughters and grandchildren, cousins and nieces. As he left Waverly Place the evening before, he had been introduced to most of them, returning from the excursion on the river. He made excuses for Anna, who had slipped away upstairs to put herself to rights. Jack wondered what she could have possibly done to chase the flush from her neck and face, and grinned to himself. All of the family members he had met so far were friendly, but 7-year-old Martha Bonner had assigned herself as his companion and inquisitor. She had come to the city from Albany with her grandfather, Adam. Adam Bonner, as he introduced himself, was lean and straight, with pure white hair cut unfashionably close to the scalp.
It set off the warm brown of his complexion and eyes of an unusual shade that could be called golden. Jack was reminded of the glow of Sophie's skin and realized that the connection must be through the New Orleans branch of the family, though he could not think of a way to ask that would not be rude. He might have come up with something if not for Martha, who demanded his attention. Like her grandfather, the little girl had a complexion that seemed to draw in sunlight. Her eyes were a milder and deeper brown, in stark contrast to the energy that bubbled out of every pore. She wanted to know his whole name, if he had sisters and brothers, how tall he was. Too tall, she announced when he told her. If he liked eggs, and whether he had dogs. Now, it seemed, she had come to a matter of greatest importance, just as he realized he had lost the thread of her conversation.
You're not listening,
she told him with a touch of impatience.
Sorry, Jack said. Pardon me. My attention wandered, but you have it now. What did you need to know?
Who is the flower girl?
And in response to his blank face,
a bride needs a flower girl. Who is Sophie's flower girl?
Jack thought back to the chaos at the house on Waverly Place when he had stopped by just an hour ago.
I don't think she has one.
But she has to, Martha Bonner said. Are you sure?
Jack said, fairly sure, yes.
Well, she said, straightening narrow shoulders, I am Sophie's second cousin once removed. Her great-grandfather, Nathaniel, is my great-great-grandfather, and she has no flower girl, and really, that's not the way things are done.
To his own surprise, Jack followed this reasoning.
They must be very distracted to have forgot something so important.
She nodded her approval and smiled, showing off the gap where her front teeth were coming in.
Anna says you have lots and lots of flowers at your house.
That is true, Jack acknowledged, but my house is far away from here.
You could take a cab, she suggested. I could help you find one.
Martha, said her grandfather as he came up to hear this part of the conversation, what devilment are you up to now?
The elderly woman on his arm gestured to her.
Martha, child, come here to me. Nobody has introduced me to this young man, so you'll have to do it.
The girl didn't hesitate.
This is Auntie Martha Bonner. Martha Bonner, like me, except old. This is Detective Sergeant Mezza...
She paused.
Mezzanotte,
Jack finished for her.
Jack Mezzanotte.
And he gently shook the hand the old lady offered, aware of the swollen joints. She looked nothing like any other member of the family. There was still a touch of red in her hair, and her skin was so fair he could see a tracery of veins just below the surface.
Aunt Martha, Adam said, excuse me, please. Your namesake and I are off in search of flowers.
He winked at her.
So you can conduct your interview in private.
You intend to marry our Anna,
Martha Bonner said, cutting right to the heart of the matter.
As soon as she'll have me, Jack agreed. But I may need a little time to learn all your names and faces, especially the names. How many Martha Bonners are there?
4, at last count. But only 2 of us here today. We are a confusing family, she said, taking his arm. So now, pay attention.
What followed was a rapid-fire sketch of the descendants of Nathaniel Bonner by 3 different women, one a youthful indiscretion, followed by 2 marriages.
But not at the same time, she clarified. So think of the family as divided into 3 branches for the 3 women, Somerville, Wolfe, and Middleton.
And you are?
I married into the Middleton line, she said. My husband was Lily's twin brother. Their little sister Bertie, your Anna's ma, was a favorite of mine.
Lily is,
They call her Aunt Quinlan these days, but you'll have to ask Anna why. Now, Birdie was the youngest of the Middleton line, and the twins the oldest, born some 20 years apart, mind you. Adam...
She looked over her shoulder, but he had disappeared with the younger Martha.
Is the Somerville line.
And Sophie...
Sophie is Hannah's granddaughter, Wolf line. It would take paper and pencil to draw it all out for you, and that will have to wait. The bride is here.
A kind of sorrowful quiet came over the old woman's face as she watched Sophie being helped down from the carriage, with Anna just behind her.
She doesn't look anything like her grandmother Hannah, but she has her spirit and her mind. I hate to think of her so far away from family when she'll most need support.
After a moment, Jack said, I've come to know Sophie fairly well. I don't think anything could change her mind.
Hannah's granddaughter, she repeated, and Curiosity Freeman's great-great-granddaughter. Strong women with excellent minds, loving hearts, loyal unto death. It's bread in the bone.
Together, Conrad and Cap had planned the ceremony with two things in mind. Cap was not strong enough to be in public for very long, and he needed to keep his distance from everyone, including the woman he was marrying. Somehow, Conrad had convinced the rector and the vicar to go along with these requirements. Anna was less sanguine about his decision to allow a small group of newspaper reporters into the back of the church, but she was certain that there was some strategy there. The papers couldn't be controlled, but they could be manipulated by means of favors granted. The rest of the reporters from the cheaper papers waited outside the gate that surrounded the church. Uninterested in the facts, they would write the stories that sold the most papers. Only so much could be handled, even by Conrad Belmont. There would be stories about the fact that none of Cap's 5 aunts were present, about Cap's finances and Sophie's childhood, and worse, the public would be reminded that Cap Verhoeven was ill unto death. One more titillating fact to add to the mess of innuendo, rumor, and half-truths that would be spun into headlines, which she imagined, unable to stop herself. Mulatto lady doctor snags dying Knickerbocker scion. He married in shame and fled the country. Old guard shaken by scandal on Park Place. With the exception of Conrad, Bram, and Baltus, and a few of Cap's household staff, the groom's side of the church was empty until Adam noticed and migrated, taking his granddaughter and a pew full of Bonners and Ballantines with him. Anna was glad of her family, sensible, observant, kind people who had long ago embraced Cap without hesitation or reservation and never wavered. Doubts they would have, she knew that. But doubts would not be voiced unless Sophie asked specifically about them. Anna wanted to listen as Sophie recited her vows, but found it almost impossible to concentrate. Her attention kept creeping away to roam through the church pew by pew, taking note of family members she had not seen for too long, and landing always on Jack. He was watching her too, and sent one of his most sincere and comforting smiles, which reminded her, whatever the newspapers printed, whatever scandal occupied the city because a white man of means had married an educated woman of mixed race, Cap and Sophie would not have to deal with any of it, and Anna would not have to deal with it alone. As soon as the vicar had declared the couple married, Cap and Sophie started down the aisle, Cap walking with the assistance of 2 canes when he might have managed with none at all. He had taken them up to provide an excuse and explanation to curious strangers who would certainly note that the bride and groom never touched as they left the church. But Sophie was smiling, and there was nothing artificial or staged about the simple joy on Cap's face, now that there was a ring on Sophie's hand. The wedding luncheon was exactly as perfect as Anna knew it would be, because Mrs. Lee and Mrs. Harrison had had the planning of it. The party gathered in the large formal dining room around a table that was set for 24 people, laid out with what had once been Clorinda Belmont's wedding china and crystal and silver. Serving staff stood at attention next to a sideboard, waiting for the signal to start. Anna's stomach growled quite reasonably, she reminded herself, as she hadn't had breakfast. She felt some of the anxious tension flow away as she sat down beside Jack. She had no work to do here, and no strangers to worry about. While the waiters served a first course of clear soup, Bram and Baltus entertained everyone with their usual irreverent observations, amusing chatter, awful puns, and worse doggerel. Most of their observations had to do with Cap, and all of them ended in the same place, with the conclusion that he had done very well for himself by marrying Sophie before anyone else could get to her. There was no talk of illness or the coming farewells. Cap was trying, but to Anna he looked to be in pain. She watched him stifle a cough, which meant that the laudanum he took to see him through the ceremony was wearing off. Through one course and two more, Anna talked to Jack and the trio of little girls. Martha had joined forces with Leah and Rosa, who came to her with one scheme after the other, and she watched Cap, comforting herself with the knowledge that in just a few hours he would be away to the docks, and what she hoped would be a peaceful Atlantic crossing. The knowledge that time was so short also made her terribly sad, and so she left Jack to his conversations with curious relatives and little girls, and went to the head of the table to crouch down beside Sophie. Her cousin leaned over and pressed her cheek to Anna's, but said nothing, though her throat worked. "So, Mrs. Verhoeven," Anna put a hand on Sophie's shoulder and squeezed gently. Sophie's smile was a little weary, but there was also a deep content in her expression. She said, "I will miss you so." "Well, of course." Then Anna pressed her mouth together to keep silent, because anything she might have been able to say would have made all three of them lose what was left of their composure. Instead, she went around Sophie to Cap. He held up a hand in warning, and she laughed at him, violating the perimeter he had set around himself to hug him, this bonier, slighter version of the boy and man she thought of as a brother.
"Provocative as ever," he said grumpily.
Anna made a face. "You can't begrudge me a single hug on the day you marry, and I need another one, as you'll be gone tomorrow on my birthday." But he turned away to cough into his handkerchief. When he began breathing again, he said,
"I hope you have something better to do on your birthday than sit in a sick room looking at me, even if I were here to look at."
Sophie shook her head at Anna. He was at the very end of his energy and irritated with himself. "Look," Sophie said, "Adam is about to start the toasts. It won't be long now." The double doors at the far end of the room opened a crack, enough to let Mrs. Harrison slip in. She stood there, one fist pressed to her diaphragm in a way that spoke of distress. With her free hand, she crooked a finger at Jack, who looked puzzled, but not particularly concerned. He shrugged at Anna and slipped away, just as Adam began his toast with a story about Sophie and Cap. As the door opened wider to let him out, Anna saw that Oscar Maroney was standing in the hall, and that another man, a stranger, stood beside him.
"This is about a prank that turned into a love story," Adam was saying.
Later, Anna couldn't recall a single sentence of what followed.
"Oscar? Captain Baker?"
The captain had appeared at Sophie Savard's wedding luncheon for no reason Jack could imagine until the older man held up a distinctive roll of paper. Jack shot an alarmed look at Oscar, who closed his eyes briefly and then held up one palm. "Wait," that palm said. But Jack could not.
What is that?
Damn coroner,
Baker huffed.
Useless bugger.
It's a summons, as you know damn well.
He looked apologetic and even embarrassed. The captain embarrassed was something new to Jack, and far more unsettling than one of his rages.
What's this about?
Oscar cleared his throat.
A Mrs. Kemble, deceased yesterday, he said. Postmortem came back this morning suggesting malpractice. Coroner Hawthorne wants to see both the lady doctors today,
he added.
Seems they both treated her.
If he hadn't been so distracted, Jack told himself, he might have anticipated that the emergency surgery of the previous afternoon was likely to have quick repercussions.
Does the coroner realize that Sophie Savard, I should say Mr. and Mrs. Verhoeven, that they are supposed to board a ship for Europe this afternoon?
Captain Baker cleared his throat.
He does know, yes.
Oscar gave a brief jerk of the head, a silent warning to Jack to hold back his commentary. Right now, they had the captain on their side, and it was important to keep it that way. Jack said,
"Give me 5 minutes,"
and slipped back into the dining room without waiting for permission. Adam was coming to the end of his toast with the attention of every person in the room firmly in hand, every person except Anna, who was looking right at Jack. He gave her a grim smile. He would put off disrupting things as long as possible. And turning, gestured to one of the servants who stood at the rear of the room. A man of 40 or more, blank-faced, not likely to make a fuss.
I need to get a message to Conrad Belmont.
Getting a quiet message to a blind man in the middle of a boisterous party would be a challenge, but the servant inclined his head and spread out a hand, waiting. Once Conrad had left the room to meet the two unexpected visitors, it didn't take long to explain the situation. While Jack read the summons out loud, he canted his head to listen. Dr. Anna Savard and Dr. Sophie Savard are hereby summoned to appear before Lorenzo Hawthorne, coroner of the City of New York, on the 28th day of May, 1883, at 2 o'clock, in his office, then and there, to answer questions in the matter of the death of Mrs. Janine Campbell.
Do you know this Hawthorne? Jack asked Conrad. I've heard the name, but I've never dealt with the man. Damn me if I'm going to break up this wedding luncheon. Hawthorne will have to wait. Will one of you talk to him? Captain Baker? Tell him we'll be there by 4.
He turned toward Oscar and said,
Would you be so kind as to send a telegram to Cunard and let them know that Mr. and Mrs. Verhoeven won't be sailing today? Mrs. Harrison will have to do something about the luggage that's gone ahead.
Just that easily, Belmont had gotten both men out of the house, and then he turned on Jack. He let out a deep sigh and pressed 3 fingers to his brow as if to locate a headache.
You're not on duty,
Jack said.
No, my allegiance here is to Anna and Sophie and Cap. Good. Good.
He was silent for another long moment. Jack could almost hear him thinking, his mind sorting through hundreds of questions and options. Jack had more than a few of his own, but he could bide his time.
Go back to the luncheon, please, and tell them it's a business matter that wouldn't wait. You'll have to convince Anna to stay where she is, then come find me in Cap's study. There's a lot to do before 4 o'clock.
Conrad Belmont was a first-class litigator and brilliant attorney. But he didn't know the Savard women. Not really. He seemed to think they could be kept in the dark while the men acted on their behalf.
You'll want Anna, Jack said. She'd be unhappy, more than unhappy, to be excluded from this business. Sophie, too, under other circumstances. I mean to protect them,
Belmont said, clearly surprised.
They won't thank you for it.
He lifted a hand in surrender.
Tell Anna to come along to the study, but I want to keep Sophie and Cap out of this for as long as possible.
The coming and going did not escape Sophie, who kept her place beside Cap at the head of the table, while her Uncle Adam talked. First Jack, then Conrad, and finally Anna had disappeared into the hall. She watched the door, but none of them came back. Cap didn't seem to have noticed, which was proof of what she had known for the last hour. He could take no more. She herself was so weary that she could not formulate even the vaguest plan on how to put a polite end to the celebration. Aunt Quinlan was saying, "On behalf of my beloved niece, Sophie, and her new husband, I thank you all for your good wishes and welcome company today. It's time that the newlyweds withdraw. They need to get ready for the adventure just ahead of them. And then I invite you all to a garden party on Waverly Place." Aunt Quinlan had seen and understood and acted. Sophie commanded herself not to weep with relief and thankfulness. When the room was empty, even the servants had withdrawn to leave Cap and Sophie alone for as long as they wanted privacy, Cap let out a long, hoarse sigh. He was trying to smile, and Sophie was trying not to cry. They made an excellent couple. The only time he had touched her today had been the moment he put the ring on her finger. But now, as they rose, he took her elbow. His grip was firmer than she would have expected.
"My body is failing me," he told her, "but my mind is still as it ever was. Tell me what's going on that took Conrad, Jack, and Anna out of the room."
She grimaced.
"I don't know. Really, I don't."
"Then we have a mystery to solve. I suspect my study is the place to start."
Anna sat at the long work table in Cap's study and ran her hands over the polished oak. Once the whole surface had been covered with a riot of papers and pens and books. Now, a single sheet of paper had been laid in the middle. A summons, with her own name on it. The men sitting at the table with her showed nothing of concern or worry, each of them so relaxed that they might have settled here to drink brandy and play poker. Anna took little comfort in this, because, as she had told Jack just yesterday evening, that aura of utter calm was a kind of camouflage that doctors had to employ too, lest they alarm patients and make things worse. Now she was learning what it felt like to want answers and get only a pleasantly blank expression. The coroner wanted to see her and Sophie both. The idea kept surfacing like a cork in a stormy sea. Clearly, the autopsy report had raised questions, and the coroner wasn't satisfied with the cause of death. Mrs. Campbell had died on her operating table, but Anna knew without doubt that she had not caused the death or even contributed to it. Any competent doctor performing the postmortem would see that too. The coroner was a very different matter. In Albany and Boston and every city of any size, coroners were the source of countless stories. Anna had heard many over the years, sometimes troubling, sometimes amusing, but most often just irritating for the depth of incompetence of the work done. She said something like this aloud.
"That's what happens," Jack pointed out. "When you ask a man who manufactures boilers or runs a silk factory to gather 12 of his friends to interpret medical evidence. Nothing they say or do is binding by law," Conrad reminded her.
"But we still have to appear when summoned," Anna said dryly. At that moment, the door opened, and Sophie came in, followed by Cap.
He said, "Uncle Conrad, I hope you don't mind if we join the party. Tell me, what is that official-looking paper on the table?"
Cap had covered his lower face with a gauze mask, and now he settled far back from the table, listening intently as Jack first read the summons out loud. Anna studied him, but she could make out little of what he was thinking. Sophie said,
I imagined a dozen things that might have disrupted this day, from old ladies throwing themselves across the church door to... She hesitated. To medical emergencies. I never imagined a summons. And I still don't know what we're being accused of. Malpractice.
No reason to jump to that conclusion, Conrad said. The inquiry is a nuisance and an inconvenience, but nothing more than that.
Cap said, Comstock is behind this. I just know it.
That may be, Conrad said. But more likely it's the family who is agitating, in my experience.
They are looking for someone to blame, Anna said. Conrad inclined his head in agreement. Today was meant to be a happy one for Sophie and Cap. But when Anna looked at them, she saw exhaustion and weariness and worry. She was overcome by anger she could not give voice to, and so she leaned over and covered Sophie's hand with her own.
This is nothing more than a delay. Do you hear me, Sophie? A delay.
Sophie forced a small smile. I have to ask again, what kind of charges might we see?
Nobody is being charged with anything yet, Jack said. The coroner can only send the case to the grand jury if he finds sufficient cause to suspect something other than natural causes. At that point, the grand jury may issue indictments for anything from... It won't get that far, Cap interrupted. It will not, his uncle echoed. But until we know what the autopsy says, it's difficult to know how best to approach the matter.
He turned toward Anna.
We have to start somewhere. Can you tell me about the case?
It was a question Jack would have asked before all others, had he had the chance to talk to Anna alone. She seemed to have been expecting it, because she sat up straighter and folded her hands in her lap. She was brought to the New Amsterdam by ambulance, near death. I took her straight into surgery, but as soon as I began, I knew there was nothing to be done. If you're asking me for an exact cause of death, I'm sorry to say it's not a straightforward matter. Cryptogenic pyemia was certainly the immediate cause, and that was the result of damage to the uterus and intestines. Conrad started visibly, and Anna realized that he really knew nothing at all about what had transpired. The idea of being charged with malpractice had not evoked for him what it did for every practicing physician. Abortion. He said,
This Mrs. Campbell died of complications of an illegal operation?
So he was familiar with the euphemisms. Yes, Anna said, an attempted abortion. Under the law, it would be seen as a criminal abortion. If she was with child at all, Sophie volunteered. That's a valid point, Anna said. So to be more exact, she died of a massive infection following from an attempted abortion. Some kind of probe or instrument was introduced through the vagina that punctured the cervix and uterus and the adjoining internal organs, most notably the descending colon. Something with a curved or oval head, with a keen but not an especially sharp edge. I am sorry to speak so bluntly, Conrad, but there is no delicate way to describe these things. Jack watched Conrad Belmont shift in his seat, and he understood the man's discomfort. In the privacy of a shared bed, he could listen to Anna talk about anything. But in company, it was quite a different matter to hear her use terminology only she and Sophie would consider it technical and benign.
A curette? Sophie asked.
Possibly, Anna said. Or a long-handled metal scraper or spoon of some kind.
Do I understand correctly that Mrs. Campbell may have undergone the operation to end a pregnancy that didn't exist in the first place? And this was her own work, self-induced?
I think it must have been, Anna said. But I can't be sure. I was working as fast as possible. The doctors who did the post-mortem will have more to say on that count.
Was she unbalanced to have done this? Conrad asked.
Anna said, Desperate, certainly.
Unbalanced is a different matter entirely. Conrad folded his hands on the table and was silent while he gathered his thoughts.
I'm going to assume for a minute that neither of you has ever been questioned by the coroner before, he began. First, you will not be under oath, and you don't have to answer any question put to you. I'll speak up if I don't want you to answer. The other thing to remember, and it's something most people don't realize at all, the coroner himself and the lawyers who question you during this hearing or at trial are not under oath.
Jack's face was set in a grim smile, and Anna took note. She would have questions for him later, when they could speak freely. Chapter 23. On the way to the coroner's office, alone in a cab with Anna, it seemed to Jack that she had regained her calm, or at least to have gotten the upper hand over her anger. Sophie had changed her clothes before they left for the coroner's office, but there hadn't been time for Anna to go home, and so she still wore the pretty gown she had put on this morning for the wedding. It was pale yellow with a raised pattern woven in. There was a name for it that he couldn't recall just now, and really, he asked himself, why was he worried about fashions at this moment? He wasn't, of course. His worries were elsewhere. He covered her hand with his own and could feel how cold it was, even through her glove. Are you worried? The question surprised him. He said,
I wish we were married already.
She smiled at him. You want some kind of legal grounding to stand beside me?
Married or not, nothing less than a bullet would move me from where I am right now.
She drew in a short, startled breath and pressed her forehead to his shoulder. He had robbed her of words and made her forget her question, which was exactly what he hoped to do. The simple truth was, he wasn't sure he could lie convincingly, and he was glad not to have to admit to her that he was very worried indeed. For Sophie, the first surprise came before she had even gotten out of the carriage in front of the coroner's office. Newspaper reporters, too many of them to count, were jostling for position like boys at a baseball game. They shouted questions before the horses came to a full stop, their voices clashing, tossing up random words impossible to overhear. Dr. Savard and Cap Verhoeven and coroner and malpractice and marriage. She wondered if the day's scandals might even warrant an extra addition.
Don't, Cap said. Don't engage them in any way. Try to keep your face neutral, Conrad said.
He sat across from her, his hat resting on his lap.
Don't respond to even the simplest question. Don't scowl, but don't smile either.
Sophie swallowed hard to make sure her voice wouldn't wobble. I will do my best. Cap was sitting tucked back into the corner of the leather cushions, his lower face still masked. Sophie saw now that it was flecked with a fine spray of blood. You should be at home, she said. Right now, turn the carriage around and go home.
Nonsense.
The gauze mask puckered when he smiled.
I am perfectly comfortable right here. We'll drive off a ways and come back to wait around the corner. Then I'll nap while we wait. Anna and Jack are here. Best to get inside as soon as possible.
The second surprise was the coroner's clerk, who was polite and even deferential. Mr. Horner greeted them in a deep, damaged voice and bowed to Sophie and Anna solemnly, without a trace of condescension or mockery. He was a tall, cadaverously thin man, dressed in an ancient black suit carefully pressed and brushed. The knotted wide linen tie at his neck didn't quite cover a winding scar, as thick and pale as a slug, reaching almost from one ear to the other. A veteran of the war, as were most men of his age. Anna was studying Mr. Horner, too, and Sophie knew her cousin was trying to work out for herself what injury the clerk had suffered, what the surgeon had done, and whether she could have done a better job and left less of a scar. This small evidence that Anna was, as always, more interested in practicing medicine than talking about it, gave Sophie a way to focus her thoughts. The issue before them was medical in nature, and medicine was her field. They were shown into a meeting room that smelled of stale tobacco and sweat, damp walls, peeling paint, windows grimy with soot, the floorboards warped. City Hall always seemed to be rotting from the inside out. Conrad's clerk was already in place, arranging papers and notepads, ink bottles and pens. Mr. Horner withdrew, closing the door behind himself, and their small party took seats around the industrious Mr. York, Conrad's law clerk, who had managed to gather a great deal of information in very little time.
"The autopsy report,"
he said, pushing a closely written sheet of paper into the middle of the table.
"It might be best if one of the physicians read it out loud, sir."
Anna took it up, to Sophie's great relief. She thought her own voice would waver, and she didn't want to give away her fear, not even to her own people. As soon as Anna began to read, Mr. York turned to the business of making notes, his head lowered over the paper before him. "It's dated 7 this morning," Anna said, and read on quickly, stopping to summarize. "He notes normal signs of multiple pregnancies and a recent birth. This is a very blunt, technical document, I should warn you."
"Read on,"
Conrad said.
"You needn't worry about offending anyone here."
Anna cleared her throat and did as she was asked. "The abdomen shows a standard laparoscopic incision neatly closed, which I reopen. I find a puncture wound that passed through the cervix to tear the uterine wall from horn to horn, made by an instrument similar in shape to a curette or probe. After sectioning and removal of the reproductive organs, intestinal and mesenteric injuries corresponding to the uterine perforation are visible. A 4-inch-long piece of the ileum is torn from the mesentery. Visceral and parietal peritoneum is filled with yellow exudate, fecal matter, serum, albumin, and approximately 2/4 of pus. A displaced intestinal loop was covered by fibrinopurulent deposits. The other abdominal organs showed no irregularities, and beyond these, none other were examined, sufficient injuries being found in the reproductive organs to reach a conclusion. Cause of death: shock, septic peritonitis, and blood loss due to an illegal, negligent, and incompetent operation carried out by person or persons unknown between 24 and 48 hours previous to death. "It's signed, Dr. Donald Manderston," she finished. "I don't know the man. Sophie?" She shook her head. "The name sounds familiar, but no."
"At least now we know why we're here," Conrad said. "The sticking point is person or persons unknown. Mrs. Campbell's injuries were not of her own making, in other words. They're looking for her abortionist."
"Only if you accept Manderston's premise," Sophie said, irritation blooming in her voice in a way she couldn't temper. "Will this Dr. Manderston be here to answer questions?"
"Oh, yes," Conrad said. "Here they come now. But Sophie, my dear, leave the asking of questions to me."
Oscar was the last man through the door, winded and wind-blown, a welcome face for all its ill humor. Somehow or another, he had managed to insert himself into this matter, which was a stroke of luck. Another detective might not be quite so forthcoming as Oscar would be when Jack hit him with some difficult questions. First and foremost, he wanted to know why it was that an assistant district attorney had taken a seat right next to the coroner. A district attorney meant that this wasn't a simple meeting to clear up a few questions. A district attorney meant blood in the water. In the company of police and prosecutors, The words, person or persons unknown, were as much as a red flag to a bull. The coroner's mindset would be pivotal. And the coroner was an unknown. Jack studied the man. He had very little to distinguish him beyond a mane of gray hair and an unruly beard. Together, they hid almost every inch of skin, while pince-nez spectacles wedged between two lowering brows caught the sun and made it difficult to see the man's eyes. Jack imagined, very briefly, a barber advancing on that wealth of hair with weapons at the ready. Hawthorne introduced everyone in the room, starting with two stout, expensively dressed men, the physicians Manderston, who had done the post-mortem, and someone called Frank Heath, apparently Mrs. Campbell's physician prior to Sophie. Manderston seemed half asleep, while Heath was agitated and jumpy. He had nodded at Anna and Sophie with obvious reluctance, and something far short of the courtesy professionals owed each other. Then Hawthorne turned to his left.
And District Attorney Mayo has joined us.
Conrad Belmont sat up straighter.
This is a simple inquiry, as I understood it. Why is the district attorney here, if I may inquire?
I asked him to join us, the coroner said shortly. And now I'd like to get started. This is a sad business before us, one that requires some examination before it can be settled. We'll work backward, I think. Dr. Anna Savard, you were the last physician to treat the deceased. Can you provide some information on your background and training?
Some of the nervous energy that Anna had been unable to completely govern seemed to disappear now that the questioning had begun. She simply provided information. What and where and with whom she had studied, her exams and qualifications, hospitals and clinics where she had seen patients, her experiences as a surgeon, organizations that she belonged to, and finally she mentioned her time studying in Vienna, Berlin, and Birmingham, England. Jack had heard all of this before, and so he concentrated on the faces of the men around the table. There was little to make out about the coroner's mindset, hidden as he was behind his beard. The clerks, three of them, Jack counted, wore identical blank expressions as they scratched away. John Mayo gave away only slightly more. But Heath's and Manderston's feelings about what they were hearing were plain to see. When Anna mentioned working in England with a Dr. Tate, Manderston sat up straight and pointed at her.
Your name was familiar to me, and now I realize why. You tried to poach one of my patients, a Mrs. Drexel. You tried to get her to leave my care.
Jack saw Anna's brow crease in confusion, and then just as suddenly clear. You are mistaken, she said calmly, but two red spots had appeared on her cheeks. Dr. Tate referred Mr. Drexel to me, and he wrote asking me to consult on his wife's case. I replied, I never heard from him again, and I never approached him or his wife. In fact, I suspected that letter to be one of Mr. Comstock's falsifications designed to entrap doctors. Jack wondered if Anna and Sophie would be relieved to know for sure that the referral had not been one of Comstock's tricks. Instead, it had just been a man's reluctance to let a woman physician treat his wife. Manderston sat back, arms crossed on his chest.
So you say?
Hawthorne rapped on the table with his fist.
Dr. Manderston, please remember why we are here. Whatever issues you have to discuss with Dr. Savard must wait. Now, Dr. Savard Verhoeven, may we hear from you?
Sophie's description of her training and experience met with even less approval from Manderston and Heath, who had begun to shift in their chairs. A question from the coroner changed all that.
Dr. Heath, you were Mrs. Campbell's physician of record until recently. How long had you been treating her?
She was my patient from the time of her marriage when she first came to this city. I last saw her in February, when she was near to term on her last pregnancy.
But you didn't attend that birth. No,
Heath said. I had to be out of town. Miss Savard, Mrs. Verhoeven agreed to go in my place.
Dr. Verhoeven,
Conrad corrected, his voice carrying sharply.
Dr. Verhoeven,
Heath echoed with a sour twist of his mouth.
Dr. Verhoeven attended the birth. That was all it was supposed to be. I didn't think she'd have the gall to steal my patient.
Belmont said,
Dr. Heath is making unsubstantiated accusations. Unless he has evidence that Mrs. Campbell was somehow coerced into seeing Dr. Verhoeven?
Heath frowned, but he had nothing to say.
As I thought, Belmont said. If I may ask a question, Dr. Heath. How did you find Mrs. Campbell when you last saw her?
He seemed ready for this question.
She was healthy. No sign or indication of trouble. And her state of mind?
Now he did look surprised, as if he had never heard such a question before.
What does that have to do with anything? It's not an unreasonable question, the coroner said. She seemed herself, nothing out of the ordinary.
Jack sat back and folded his hands across his midsection, ready to sit through what promised to be one of Belmont's infamous wandering explorations, designed, it seemed to Jack, to extract information by artful prodding. Within a half hour, he had Heath tripping over his own tongue, admitting that he didn't know about Mrs. Campbell's state of mind because he hadn't asked her, and he hadn't asked her because, well, he said, turning a hand, palm up, what difference did it make? After a short silence, the coroner turned to Sophie.
Dr. Verhoeven, you delivered Mrs. Campbell in March, as I understand it.
Sophie agreed that she had.
Did you see her after she gave birth in March?
Yes, I called on her 2 days later to make sure she was healing, and then she came to see me in my office some weeks ago.
All heads came up abruptly.
I don't think I had that information, said Hawthorne. She came to see you in your office. For what reason?
She asked me to examine her.
Uh-huh. And what were your findings?
She was a healthy young woman about a month postpartum. That is, she was physically healthy, but very melancholy and even despairing.
As is common after any birth,
Heath interjected.
Not to this degree.
Sophie contradicted him. Heath gave a dismissive wave of the hand. The coroner said,
Did she give a reason for her state of mind?
Sophie didn't hesitate.
She believed herself to be with child, and she was terrified about another pregnancy so soon.
She said that exactly.
No, Sophie said. As I remember her words, she said, I just can't have another baby so soon. It will be the end of me.
Jack saw no surprise or even concern on the faces around the table. And for the first time, he got a sense of what Anna and Sophie meant when they talked about men's willful blindness.
Mrs. Campbell was with child.
The coroner was asking for confirmation of what he believed to be true, but Sophie was not so easily led.
She may have been, she said, but it was too early to tell by examination.
She had an active imagination.
Heath ignored the sharp look that Sophie sent him, and Hawthorne seemed not to notice. He said,
Did you operate on Mrs. Campbell, Dr. Savard?
Conrad cleared his throat.
Pardon me, the coroner said. Dr. Verhoeven.
I did not, Sophie said.
Did she ask you for the name of someone who would perform an abortion?
She did not.
Did you volunteer names of such persons? That is a leading question, Conrad said. Please rephrase or I will instruct my client not to answer. I'll let it go for the moment. Dr. Savard, you did operate on Mrs. Campbell.
Yesterday, Anna said. Yes.
And previous to that?
I never saw Mrs. Campbell previous to her arrival at the New Amsterdam yesterday.
You've read Dr. Manderston's report. Do you agree with his finding on the cause of death?